Welcome, everyone, to Island Coast Radio. I'm Mike Taylor.
I'm Diane Constell.
And I'm Erica Popino.
Tonight, oh boy, do we have a show. Who do we have on?
We have Lloyd Auerbach.
Big show.
Big show. Let's get right to this interview because Lloyd is on the line right now. Diane, you want to give the intro for Lloyd?
Yes, Lloyd is the director and founder of the Office of Paranormal Investigations, which is based in the San Francisco Bay Area. He also holds a BA in Cultural Anthropology from Northwestern University and an MS in Parapsychology from JFK University. He's written numerous books, including his most famous title, ESP, Hauntings, and Poltergeist. He teaches seminars, workshops, and lectures at colleges, universities, conventions, conferences, and corporate events. He's been a consultant to many television programs all over the world and has appeared on scores of television and news programs, and he loves chocolate. I could go on and on, but we need an entire show to list Lloyd's credentials.
Lloyd, you love chocolate?
I love chocolate. It's my latest passion.
Chocolate is my favorite meal of the day.
Yeah. I actually I do chocolate tastings, in fact, and like seminars and things, and even I'm making my own chocolate now, just playing with that.
Oh, wow.
The Lloyd Auerbach chocolate?
Well, it's Haunted by Chocolate.
Ah, I love the name.
Really?
It's the name of my website, and it's going to be the name of the chocolate too.
And you sell it?
No, I don't yet. I'm still playing with the formula. I have some things in mind that I'm going to be planning with it, so it'll be a little while before I get to the sales part yet.
Cool. The Lloyd Auerbach 11 Secret Herbs and Spices.
Lloyd, is it true you became a parapsychologist because you were inspired by the TV show Ghost Hunters?
Oh.
I'm kidding, Lloyd. I'm kidding.
About 10 years ago?
I'm kidding, of course.
There was a British series called Ghost Hunters.
Yes.
About 10 years ago.
Yeah, we have that one on DVD.
Yeah.
That's an interesting show.
I was inspired by shows like Topper and Star Trek and Dark Shadows and The Sixth Sense.
So I have to ask, being a parapsychologist, does it bother you that there are so many people that watch like a few episodes of Ghost Hunters and decide to start investigating the paranormal?
It's kind of a scary thing when it comes right down to it, to be honest. The idea that you can watch any TV show and suddenly go out and do it. I mean, you don't watch, let's face it, if Jay and Grant were doing plumbing on TV, you wouldn't go by what you saw on television. It was literally a do-it-yourself show.
No, definitely not.
And, you know, the Home and Garden Network, when you see Home Improvement type shows, they go through step by step, and you've never seen that on Ghost Hunters.
I agree. That is one of my criticisms of the show.
It's not the right venue to be doing to be teaching, but at the same time, people should not be emulating stuff they see on TV. Unless you're, I guess if you watch Cops, you can go out and be a cop too that way.
You can't.
I have a badge and everything. I thought I could do that.
You probably could try for a little while, but at some point you're going to get shot. Fortunately, with ghost hunting, you're not likely to get shot unless you run into some crazy people.
God,
I want to be a vigilante.
I mean, you put the average paranormal investigator to shame, and you make me want to hang up my tri-field meter.
Yeah. How long have you been a parapsychologist, Lloyd?
I've been involved in the field since I got into grad school in 79, and technically, I guess you could say I was a parapsychologist shortly after I graduated from JFK with my master's degree in 81. I started working at the American Society for Psychical Research in 82, so that's pretty much the time frame.
Why did you choose parapsychology? What inspired you?
The reason I got interested was because, literally, of those TV shows I mentioned from the 60s. I was a science geek as a kid and also into mythology and science fiction and comic books, and there were just so many things around the field of parapsychology when I discovered it, that it existed as a kid. I was probably about 11 or 12 when I really kind of started reading some of Ryan's books and some of the books that were in the library. At that point, it was interesting because it really was the only field of science that was looking at human potential as kind of, saying that we're more than we think we are. And I even started a parapsychology club in my high school back in the New York area, in Elmsford, New York. I had a couple teachers who were interested, and as it happens, there were two of the science teachers and a number of my friends, and we had a parapsychology society in my old high school at least while I was there, and it actually lasted a couple years after I was gone, too.
Wow. That's cool. I would have gotten beaten up if I tried to create a club like that. You're very lucky. You actually be able to, the school is actually allowing you to create a club like that.
Well, it was a little bit of a struggle. I had to convince the principal that this was not something weird. I mean, he had this, I remember him having this quizzical look on his face like, power what? And I wrote to J.B. Ryan at his lab, and he actually sent a really nice supportive letter. And some of the area parapsychologists in the New York area, actually, I got to meet one of them through one of my neighbors who was a yoga teacher, and he was one of our students. So they lend their support as well. So it was not that, I mean, it was a little bit of a strange thing to go through, but it wasn't that tough. And what we mainly did, though, was not what the groups today do. We did research. We actually did ESP tests and psychokinesis experiments. We had, even though computers were at that time in the 70s on teletype via modem, acoustic coupling modem, we were able to create a computer program to test people's ESP and got to meet a lot of parapsychologists in the area. So we never really, even though we went to a couple hundred places on tour, just places that were repeatedly haunted, we never really did any investigating because that wasn't the point of the club at that time.
Right. Well, we get new listeners all the time, and some might not be familiar with the term parapsychology. Can you tell us what a parapsychologist is?
Well, parapsychology is a study of how the human mind, or conscious mind in general, connects with the world around it. So without the use of the normal senses or through logic or other inference that one might make. So parapsychology studies how the mind or consciousness directly interacts with the rest of the world. And that includes what we call ESP, the idea we can pick up information or transmit information without the use of the normal senses. We can do mind over matter or mind-matter interaction, which is everything from psychic healing to moving objects to possibly even teleportation in some strange way. And the third area is survival of bodily death, the idea that this consciousness, this mind that we have, can survive the death of the body and hopefully communicate, which is what we call an apparition or a ghost. So the field actually has been around as psychical research before parapsychology, but since 1882 and the founding of the Society for Psychical Research. And these three areas, ESP, psychokinesis, PK, and survival, are the three main areas, but they're interrelated very, very heavily. I mean, you can't really do any sort of study of apparitions without really considering extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. And you really can't do poltergeist work without looking right at psychokinesis, because that's what it is. So you have to kind of look at the whole framework of things. And I guess the biggest bugaboo I've got with the ghost hunting groups out there is that they don't even know the word parapsychology. They don't even know the science that their activity falls under, and yet they're claiming to be scientific.
Yeah, I know that we claim on our website that we're trying to do things, you know, quote unquote scientific, but really, how do you measure these things? I mean,
well, you know, measurement is not the be all end all of science. That's the problem.
Yeah,
the American public, partly because of the education system and partly because of TV, has a really bad idea what science would equate to science. A lot of people think that if you use technology, use equipment, you are doing science. The reality is you're just using equipment. You're not doing science at all.
Right. Any monkey can hold a meter.
Right.
And we do.
Flicking back and forth. So it's really about what you do with that equipment and what you do with the information from that equipment and what you do with the information of the case and how you pull all that together. And you need to always consider that we are dealing with the human mind. Whether you want to believe that ESP is involved or not, if you're dealing with a ghost, you're dealing with a mind. It's a dead guy, but it's still a mind. And if something moves, by definition, that's still psychokinesis. So you have to kind of look at the models that are out there or create your own model, but you need to create theories, create models, and then test them, and that's what science is about.
Right. Now, you had mentioned poltergeist. When I was growing up, poltergeist, to me, the definition was always noisy ghost. However, today the name poltergeist is a bit of a misnomer. I think many people are confused because poltergeist activity has to do more with psychokinesis than ghosts.
Actually, if it was a ghost, it's still psychokinesis. The definition
right.
of psychokinesis is minor or matter. But you're right. We deal with living people's PK rather than a ghost.
Well, can you tell us what the definition today is for poltergeist?
Well, the translation of the word, it's a German word from the 16th century. The translation is still noisy ghost. The translation hasn't changed. The definition from the model in parapsychology, which has been, by the way, it's like decades, many decades old. It's not a recent model, is a situation in which physical object movements and other physical effects are happening, things that people could absolutely witness. They're not a psychic thing, other than the cause of these objects moving may be psychic or paranormal. And they center around living person, a living agent, and seem to be related to that person's unconscious mind and stress and other emotional upset that they might be going through at that time. And we have attributed those movements to the living person's unconscious because, with very rare exception, no ghosts are ever seen or experienced in any other way. So nobody's seen, nobody's heard, nobody's felt. There's just physical stuff. And secondly, this is where we did the hypothesizing, the theorizing, and the testing of this by playing detective and determining who the agent is. And then working with that person, you can get the phenomena to stop. And that, through very simple deduction, leads to the idea that it's the living agent who's doing it.
So why did it become poltergeist? Why didn't poltergeist remain just the definition of noisy ghost? And then the psychokinesis activity that happens around people who are suffering from like mental stress, why didn't they get a new name for that?
Well, there is a new name for it. It's just that in common usage, first of all, the problem is that the term poltergeist was applied to a very specific, you know, situation back in the 16th century in Germany.
Right.
And that was physical object movement. They assumed, because they didn't know any better and no way of figuring it out, that it was a ghost.
Right.
You know, any unusual activity must be a ghost. I mean, that was the whole, it's either a ghost or a god or a demon. I mean, that's pretty much all your three choices there, because they didn't even think about aliens back then. So that's the term that was applied to that particular situation. And if there was a ghost seen, that was a geist. That was a different kind of ghost. So this was a very specific situation. But as the situation, study of the situation and of ghosts in general developed, it was clear that these were different things. These two things are different things. But the name had been used already for three centuries.
Right.
So it was already kind of connected to that situation. And this is not the only area that, you know, words change all over the place.
Yeah.
Lightning doesn't mean the same that it did way back when, for example.
Hmm.
People use the term electricity today. Well, you know, that word was used well before we knew what electricity was.
Yeah.
What we know it is today is different than what we thought it was way back when. So things do change. The term we use today in parapsychology is RSPK. It's recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, just not as sexy as poltergeist.
Well, Lloyd, I have a question. Years ago, I read a book called The Intruders about a haunted building in Lombard Street in San Francisco. Are you familiar with that?
Pat Montandon case, yes.
Yeah, I read that book actually twice. It was so, I mean, I think I read that book about 20 years ago. And just to give people a background on it, this woman, Pat, lived in this apartment building, and she had a party where she invited, you know, tarot card readers and psychics and things like that. And somehow she pissed off the tarot card reader, and this person supposedly put a curse on her apartment. And she started having all of these freaky things happen and people dying and fires and things like that. Wait.
Sorry, couldn't resist.
Okay. But I wanted to find out, do you think that something was really with that, or do you think it was just the power of suggestion and a lot of coincidences?
Well, it's probably a whole bunch of things. You know, that case was well before my time, before I even came out to the West Coast. So I haven't met anybody who was involved with that. A couple of times I tried researching it, but I wasn't able to find anybody who was connected to it. First of all, my guess is the book was highly exaggerated, like most books tend to be in this situation. But, you know, the idea that somebody put a curse on a place and suddenly all this stuff happened is so unlikely to the extreme. It just doesn't work that way. Things don't work that way. There's no such thing as that kind of curse. You can affect people through suggestion, and certainly even your negative thoughts, in some respect, if people are open to it, can receive that. But it, you know, part of the problem is that in poltergeist cases, we occasionally have situations where people are stressed out because of something they think is paranormal. I even had a poltergeist case caused by an apparition who was appearing in a house and really just trying to get help from the family. But his appearance, the idea that a ghost was there, freaked them out so much that they're literally, the stress was caused a poltergeist outbreak.
Wow. It's like a domino effect.
Yeah, when we walked in, I walked in with a psychic, a friend of mine, Annette Martin, who I work with quite heavily. And Annette's been around for many years. She works with police on many cases and has been around quite a long time. And she started laughing as soon as we walked in, because apparently she walked over to the corner and she said, there's this guy here, and he's very vociferously saying that he had nothing to do with the object movements, the breakage and stuff like that. He has nothing to do with it. And then he pointed at one of the people in the family, who it turned out was the poltergeist agent.
Interesting.
But we helped him move on, and then we had to deal with the other stuff, because the stuff continued after he moved on, because the stress wasn't gone yet. The Montana case could have been a situation where they were so freaked out that with, number one, power suggestion, you notice things. Secondly, it may have actually caused some physical stuff, too. And who knows, the place might have been haunted, and the tarot card reader might have pissed off somebody that was in the house, too.
Right. Well, and also, her other big book was something about being a party girl, so it makes you kind of wonder what was going on there. But it was very entertaining, and it had a really cool three-dimensional cover.
Yeah, it is. I still have a copy of that book. It's definitely an entertaining book.
Now, you work with Annette Martin. We don't have a psychic in our group. It's not that we're closed to using one. We just find a lot of psychics, they either want money, you know, they're not into it for the research.
That's right. That's very true. Unfortunately, that is the case.
Yeah. So how would you recommend finding a credible psychic?
You don't really need a professional psychic. What you need, you know, one of the ways that I've actually worked with folks which has kind of worked out very well, is on occasion you run into people in cases that they may have been afraid to begin with, maybe not. They had a real experience. They saw a real ghost. They're not professional psychics by any means, but they had real experiences. And if they get interested enough, and if they're curious enough at the end of their situation and okay enough about the phenomena, I might invite them along on another case to see how well they do. I mean, they've already shown me that they can see a ghost, so why not see if they can see a ghost in another situation? And that has worked. I don't usually take them on every case. I take just pick and choose people here and there, and that can work pretty well, just realizing that sometimes they don't know how to interpret what they get, so it's really important that they just spout, or you know, whatever they see, whatever they hear, without any judgment. Just tell us what you're seeing, tell us what you're hearing, and then try to figure out how that relates to what the witnesses are experiencing.
So you think seeing a ghost is all it's psychic ability, kind of? Everybody has it, but...
You know, the problem is it could be psychic ability on the part of the ghost. It may be that there's a connection made between... It is not the case that a person always sees ghosts after they've seen one.
Right.
But I've tried, and it has worked sometimes. It worked very well. But the connection between the person who sees the ghost and the ghost is a psychic connection. It's a telepathic connection.
It does seem like...
That's the model we're work off of. Because it's not a visual one. It's clearly not a visual one, because not everybody in the room is seeing the ghost, and you can't take a picture of him.
It seems like a lot of people that see ghosts see them repeatedly. Not the same ghost I'm talking about, but people that have paranormal experiences throughout their life have them, and then there's people that don't have any.
Right. You know, there are people who have really good artistic ability and people who don't have any.
So you think it's kind of the same thing?
It's definitely, you know, psychic ability is connected to the creative impulse. That's something that's been very clear. And it is a human performance issue, and it has to do with how we are growing up, too. Kids tend to be much more psychic. Most kids tend to be fairly psychic and open until they learn not to be. And the way our society teaches kids, and the way their parents often talk about this phenomena, it is not a supported interest or ability in most people. I mean, there are situations where kids are artistic prodigies or musical prodigies, and their parents, who hate art or music, tell them, you know, basically beat it out of them.
Yeah.
Whether it's verbally or otherwise. And there are kids that grow up thinking they're stupid because their parents tell them they're stupid.
Do you think that there's a link between people that have experienced near-death experiences and having psychic experiences?
Well, yeah, there's clearly something that goes on in the near-death experience. You know, not everybody has the psychic opening that some people do. I think it's about 15% of the people who have had a near-death experience that affects them in some emotional or philosophical way tend to have a psychic ability. They're much more, and it's probably because they're much more open to it. They've actually already had a psychic experience to begin with, so they may be significantly open to their minds being more than what it is. I think that's kind of a big step. If you can accept that there's more to us than this flesh and blood and body and brain and such,
right,
and kind of start thinking in that direction, and certainly a near-death experience can put you in that mindset, you're going to start having psychic experiences more often.
Okay. I had a near-death experience when I was 9. I had a bad accident, got hit in the head, and since then I've been having – this is why I'm doing this. I've been having paranormal experiences since then.
Mm-hmm.
So I just
it's definitely not unusual. You know, as a 9-year-old, you probably didn't have the life-changing philosophy situation that adults tend to have.
Right.
But that's certainly something that was probably connected to your experience.
Interesting.
Well, Lloyd, I mean, if the consensus is that ghost sightings are due to the viewer receiving images psychically, how do you explain the handful of photographs taken of what appear to be ghostly human images?
Well, the issue about photographs is that we think, and this is the same thing, by the way, this is the same thing with EVP. If you talk to folks like Tom and Lisa Butler from the American Association of EVP, Electronic Voice Phenomena, you're going to hear the same thing. It's psychokinesis.
Right.
It's psychokinesis on the part of the ghost. I mean, the ghost is not reflecting light, so therefore there is nothing to take a picture of. So what's happening there is the ghost would have to consciously affect the film or affect the device itself, the digital camera, to change something to actually appear on that picture.
Right. For lack of a better word, transmit their energy somehow.
Right, we've heard you say.
Transmit their image, transmit an effect, basically. And we know living people can, there are people who have in the past been able to affect film and certainly digital equipment. People can affect digital equipment. We have enormous laboratory evidence for that. But people have definitely been able to affect film from time to time. Ted Sirius was a good example of that in the 60s and early 70s. And so we know that living people have been able to do it and put images on film from time to time. And one would assume that if you're dead and you've got no body, you hopefully try to figure out how to do some other things.
I don't want to get on into the whole orb controversy, and I'm not a fan of dust or anything like that. But there was one time that I did actually see a ball of light. And
oh, yeah.
I actually had a camera that was on when I saw it, and I photographed it. So how do you explain that?
Well, just remember that because something's round and glowing, it doesn't mean it's the same thing as a round and glowing thing in a picture. Those can be two different things. And there are things called earthlights. I've seen them myself. They are plasma effects. They're static electric effects that are caused by particular mineral formations in the ground. They literally create balls of light. Some of them can be actually pretty big. They've been mistaken for UFOs on occasion.
Right.
And they can be photographed. They are giving off light.
Right. So it's energy.
It is absolutely energy. I mean, that's a physical thing.
But what's weird is it was in a cemetery, so that kind of makes it.
Yeah, and Erica actually.
Yeah, that's kind of a weird thing. We have a coal mine that's closed down, and there's a lot of those kinds of earthlights that are reported around there. And there's actually a cemetery right on the edge of the old coal mine area, so they appear in the cemetery there too. It just depends on the mineral strata, what's there. That's what's going to determine whether or not you're going to have these earthlights form.
Right.
But how do you explain the fact that Erica asked it to appear? Because she had been to the cemetery before, and she had seen
an apparition.
And she
maybe there was a ghost there who kind of juiced things up a little bit.
Right. I actually asked it to show itself, and it did appear like the size of a basketball, a ball of white light, and I photographed it.
Hmm. Well, it's funny. A lot of us were there, but no one else saw it but Erica.
No one else saw the image?
No.
No, I just think nobody was looking, because how could you not see it?
That, I mean, that is the problem a lot of times. You're looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
I think half the reason why people say that they don't see things that are happening in a place is because the ghost does things behind your back.
Yeah.
Now, Lloyd, many people seem to ghost hunt in cemeteries, but cemeteries are not necessarily known for haunted activity.
No, they're not.
Yeah.
They're not, but they're spooky.
Right.
You got to remember that, again, we're back to your very first question about ghost hunters and shows like that.
Yes.
There is this idea on TV that has been created by the television industry that spooky is what ghost hunters do. And I mean, I've been doing TV since the early 80s, and whenever I've gone on a field piece, they want to, they often want to make it atmospheric and spooky. And back then, we didn't have night shot. So, I can't believe I'm talking about the 80s as the olden days. But anyway.
Believe me, we feel your pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't have night shot. And you really, I mean, if they were going to go out at night for atmosphere, you had to have the lights on. You had to. I mean, the camera lights had to be on, if nothing else. So, and the reality is, we never investigate in the dark. There's no reason to investigate in the dark unless that's the only circumstance where people are experiencing something. That's the only reason to investigate in the dark.
What about the theory that places are haunted that, where there's a lot of human emotion, like cemeteries jails?
Well, that's the thing. Now, we have to talk about hauntings here differently than ghosts, because in reality, cemeteries can be very haunted by an imprint of the emotion, and the emotion at cemeteries is often despair and sadness.
Right.
So people will, and people can even see, perceive images of the mourners, not going to see the people who are dead because they're on the ground and their bodies were probably not even on view in the cemetery. And it's the living that leave those impressions, not the dead. The emotion that seems to come in these haunting situations comes from living people, not deceased people. A good example of that is, and I've heard people have asked about these kinds of, I went to this place and there was a murder there, and you can see the people have seen the murderer doing the deed over and over again. That guy is haunting the place. Well, the problem is that it may have been a recent murder. In some instances, it is a recent murder, and the murderer is in jail, alive.
Yes.
Wow.
So he's not haunting the place. His, I guess you could say, his recording is haunting the place.
Well, that also explains when someone passes away and a relative sees them at the moment that they pass. They're not quite dead yet, but somehow they appear.
That's actually the majority of apparitional cases are, I think, probably 99% of all ghost sightings happen within a couple days of the person's death, if not at the time of death. And it's either, I mean, we look at it a couple ways. It could be that that person is reaching out with their minds to say goodbye. It could also be that, you know, they're kind of making the rounds to say goodbye to everybody. It also could be that people are aware, psychically aware, that the person has just died, and we ourselves, the I guess you could say the receiver, is creating this image of that person to make us aware that the person has just died. I mean, all those things are possible.
Well, I actually have had two friends in my life whose family member passed away, and they actually encountered that person. I had a friend whose father passed away on a Christmas Eve, and 2 weeks later, his father appeared to him in his parents' bedroom and basically just said, take care of your mother, and he disappeared. And another friend was visiting her cousin's grave at the cemetery. It's actually here on Long Island. And she turned, it was about 2 weeks after he'd passed away, and she turned around and she actually saw him crossing the road toward her in the cemetery, and she just freaked out. She ran away. just left.
That was dumb.
Yeah. Well, she did regret it afterwards. She actually drove back, and she never saw him again. And he,
sometimes you only get one shot.
He was like a brother to her. He was a cousin, and they grew up together, and they were very close.
Yeah, the people's reactions is often one of fear. You know, most of the time when the friend or relative or loved one is appearing to people, I think the fear is, if there is any fear, it's either afterwards you think about what happened, or during it you're afraid the person has actually died, which is that's a real fear.
Right.
Yeah. So do you believe that most hauntings, residual events, have more to do with retrocognition or time slips?
Well, you know, that's a good question. We're not really sure. And just for those listening, retrocognition is the ability to perceive the past, just like precognition is the ability to perceive the future.
Right.
You know, it's hard to say. I think one of the, there's a possibility here for research that is something that someone out there can do. I don't have the wherewithal to do it right now. But Michael Persinger, who is the guy who did the initial research, really did the research on how electromagnetic fields affect or are connected to psychic experiences, which then led to some other research he did, I'll get to in a moment. He was up in Laurentian University in Canada, and he found connections between the Earth's magnetic fields, highs and lows, and psychic experience. And then he went on to create kind of simulate those highs and lows using a helmet in his lab, and was able to cause, depending on how he regulated that simulated field of the Earth, which is a very low-level field, by the way, he was able to cause people to have hallucinations, including near-death experiences and mystical experiences and such. And some of us started talking about the idea that maybe we can start measuring the Earth's magnetic field or other magnetic fields and see if there's any correlations or connections with haunted places. And that's where the idea of using the tri-field actually came from. Both Andy Nichols and I, Andy's in Florida, coincidentally happened to came across the tri-field meter in the 80s and started using the tri-field meters, and I believe I may be the first one to use one on TV from what people have told me. It's kind of my fault, unfortunately. But we did find correlations. We found connections between these place memory, these places that had memory of past events, and unexplained magnetic fields. What the experiment could be, which you can buy a helmet called a Schottky helmet, which simulates what Michael Persinger's work in the lab does, and you can actually have an experience with this helmet. It can actually cause you to have an altered state experience or a near-death experience, things like that. It'd be really interesting to take one of those suckers to Gettysburg, fire it up, and see, as you play with the settings, whether you can cause someone to have an experience of the battle.
You know, just get a giant helmet and put it over the battlefield.
Well, supercharge the event, yeah, that's possible too. You know, but then you might just transmit everybody through time, and we don't want that.
Hey.
Well, that's the funny thing about these events. You never hear someone say, I saw an apparition of a man, and he was wearing a tricorder and a phaser. It's never future events. It's always, I saw a woman in a Victorian dress.
Well, yeah, I mean, because the past gets recorded, and the future doesn't look to be actually formed at this point.
Right, but wouldn't you think that a time slip could go either way?
Well, time slip apparently could go either way, one would expect, but whether it's reaching out to a parallel universe, as we get into the weird physics area here, or whether we're reaching into a probable future, a possible future, is hard to say, or you saw that guy with, you know, who looked like an alien and with a weird ray gun and turned out, you know, all you're picking up on is an imprint of a past Star Trek convention.
Hey, I might have been there.
Lloyd, are you a believer in UFOs and aliens?
Well, first, all right. First of all, let's just define things. UFO stands for unidentified flying object.
Yes.
Yes, there are things in the air that fly that we don't know what they are.
Doesn't mean it's from another world.
Yeah, that's different than saying, are there spacecraft visiting? And you know, the answer to that is I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay.
I don't buy all the abductions that are reported because there's just way too many for the populace. It seems like every other person's been abducted, and it's just a kind of an insane number.
But Lloyd, what explains my anal probe?
You know,
sorry.
There's just some things that parapsychologists don't go to. as far as the alien, you know, when I was in college, my freshman sophomore year, I volunteered at the Center for UFO Studies a bit. It was started by the late J. Allen Hynek. And I got to read, you know, part of what I did as a volunteer was go through all these sighting reports from all sorts of kinds of people, including ones that may have been classified for other reasons. I mean, Hynek had copied them from Project Blue Book, and just really classifying them as to what type of things they were, whether they were daylight disks or nighttime lights and things like that. And I got to talk to Hynek a lot. And, you know, there was a real question as to how much is nuts and bolts hardware, how much is some sort of projection, how much, you know, and how much of it is aliens and from other dimensions versus other planets, and all these things are possible. What I have a hard time with is, again, the number of abductions. And there certainly have been some really good abduction cases. Hynek even had a couple himself. But whenever if somebody doesn't remember them in any other circumstance, and they just come out in hypnosis, there's a real problem.
Right.
Because of suggestion. So those almost have to, even though the people really believe them, you have to go past those.
Well, the Betty and Barney Hill case in New Hampshire was pretty interesting.
Yeah, now that was interesting for a number of reasons beyond just putting somebody under hypnosis, and that the circumstances that happened, that they both had missing time, that Betty was able to describe things that later on were shown by an astronomer to be a perspective of a star from a different direction. I mean, there were all sorts of things that really said something had likely happened to them. There was a case that Hynek investigated, in fact, right before I went to Northwestern, a couple of fishermen in Pascagoula, Mississippi, a young guy and an old guy. And that case actually had the close encounters of the first, second, and third kind. I mean, there was physical evidence at the site of a land of something. There were the two guys who had experiences. There was a lot of other people who saw the UFO at the time. So there was a lot to support that their experience was genuine. And as Hynek put it, he actually got one of the guys drunk at a party as they were making the rounds of some of the talk shows. And he said, you know, his story held up even if he didn't.
Well, aren't there the guys? There was one guy, he actually started growing back like a third set of teeth. I remember that story.
I don't remember that ever happening.
Actually, no. I actually have a UFO book. I think actually got that in. It was the young guy and the older guy, and I think the older guy said he started growing teeth again.
That's possible. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I certainly haven't seen that part of it, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some other effect, because there certainly were some other things going on at the time.
Well, that also brings up, regarding psychic phenomena, why does it seem limited to our known world? I mean, in your research, has anyone ever had psi experiences involving other worlds or beings?
Well, it's hard to know, because when people start describing such things, it's tough to know what they're actually getting, because we have nothing to compare it to.
Mm.
So we really don't know. I mean, some of the things that people who are in, you know, under mental health care may actually be legitimately real. It's just really hard to know, because we don't have any way to judge it. And a lot of times it happens when they're in extreme altered states of consciousness. And we, again, have no way to judge whether that reality actually exists for them to connect with to begin with. You know, I actually saw something interesting by one of the online ghost hunting groups that's been around for over 10 years. It has claims to have thousands of members. And in one of their newsletters, they said they started talking about parallel universes and stated that they were proven by physicists to exist. And it's like, you know, that is the dumbest statement I've ever heard. from someone who claims to know what he's talking about, because that has not been proven. In fact, we don't actually know what gravity is. We don't know how it works exactly. We don't know what it is, whether it's a force or something else.
Well, there's not even gravity. It's a bending of time space.
Well, that's one theory.
Right.
That it's not a force, that it actually is just the effect of time space bending because of mass.
Right.
And things rolling towards the center of that.
Yeah, who knows?
And we don't know what time is. There's a book came out a couple of years ago by a physicist called The End of Time, where the physicist suggests that there is no such thing as time. It's all a consciousness-related quantum function.
Right.
And if we weren't aware, if we didn't make it artificial by considering the passage of time, time wouldn't even exist.
Right.
You know, for a physicist to say something like that, it sounds kind of crazy when you think about it.
Well, it's just our way to keep track of things. I mean, everything seems just constant. If you just sat there and just, like, you wouldn't feel anything moving. You're just there.
And yet we know that time is not constant because there are physics experiments that have proven that time is different at different relative speeds.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. When are we going to be able to open up universities for paranormal so we could all get on the same page and for ghost hunters to be out there? Like, for instance, I was looking at your website, www.mindreader.com, and you have some great, great information, and I suggest everybody goes to the website and reads it. And we're all walking around ghost hunting with cameras, and I'm sure it hasn't crossed 90-something percent of the investigators out there that are taking photos. You believe that ghosts as well as living people through the use of psychokinesis imprint anomalies on their photos.
Right.
And
that's right.
You know, who thinks of that? I mean, what am I doing then with my camera? What have I been doing all these years?
Well, that's the problem. See, it's the same thing with EVP again, is we don't really know if those voices are coming from just someone who is imprinting a voice on their recording device, whether it's coming from the living person, or more likely, it's probably kind of... It's interesting that some people get EVP consistently and many people don't get it at all.
Yeah.
And that there's some who get it occasionally. And that would indicate that the person who's doing the recording has something to do with it. Now, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily responsible for all the EVP, but it may be that they're acting as a medium between the dead guy and the recording device. I mean, it may be that they're kind of completing a circuit. So there may be even a psychic ability to do EVP that helps them connect with people who are deceased without them realizing. They need technology to do it. They're techno mediums.
So can it be the same with a camera?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, the problem is there's a couple problems with cameras. And just going back to the orb thing, we know where the orb idea came from in terms of how it got connected to ghosts. And
right,
there is no logic whatsoever. In fact, before it was connected, the orbs were connected to ghosts. The very few orbs that appeared before, very few, before digital cameras came out and before flashes got more powerful on cameras, which is kind of a telling thing right there.
Yeah.
The very few orbs, people would often, the UFO community had claimed orbs well before the ghost community.
Yes.
And the other dimensional community had claimed orbs well before the ghost community. So why is it suddenly that, you know, okay, so ghosts, according to this person, are everywhere, and orbs show up everywhere, therefore ghosts must be orbs. And, you know, I could say, well, dust is everywhere, and orbs appear everywhere, so orbs must be dust. I mean, you could say the same thing. So, and then I'm sure there are people who say fairies are everywhere, and orbs are everywhere, so ghosts must be fairies. Orbs must be fairies.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no logic. It makes no sense to connect those things.
I think it's because these digital cameras get smaller and smaller, and the flash gets closer to the lens, and every time that flash goes off, it's illuminating, you know, dust particles, and people...
There's a very, very simple thing that somebody can do, anybody can do. It's a little hard. I will say that it's actually a little harder now with most basic digital cameras or regular cameras, because used to be that you could hook up an external flash to almost any kind of camera. They always had a port for that. But, you know, it's hard to find a camera that lets you hook up an external flash to a camera these days that's less than $500 or $600. But the simplest thing to do is to either turn the lights on and not use a flash at all, or one thing you could actually do is duct tape two cameras side by side together and turn the flash off on one of them and make sure you set them off both at the same time so the flash of the one also helps the other one. And now because of the focal length and where the flash is on the second camera, on the camera without the flash, you're not going to get orbs.
How do you feel about infrared photography?
Well, first let's consider why infrared photography was ever used to begin with in psychical research, because, you know, again, this is where history is important. The early researchers were very interested in and did a lot of investigation of spirit mediums, people who claimed they could talk to the dead, as well as people who claimed that spirits worked through them to allow them to move things, or to do physical things like levitations and such. And initially, most of the mediums worked in full or partial light. They didn't work in the dark.
Right.
It was when this became theatrical entertainment, and some of the frauds and entertainers came up and said, this will work much better if we turn the lights out, that the spirit mediums themselves, the real mediums, almost got pushed into working in the dark. Just like if I do a TV show, they tell me I have to work in the dark. It's like, I won't do that. But the mediums kind of had no choice because that's what all the people expected. And so the researchers now are faced with this problem where they want to know what's going on in the dark, and so they use infrared photography to try to catch the frauds because there was a lot of it. They weren't doing it to try to catch ghosts because they didn't think they could catch ghosts that way.
Right.
They did it to try to catch the frauds.
You mean the people with the cheesecloth coming out of their nose?
Yeah, the cheesecloth coming out of their nose or other bodily orifices for that matter. So, while there are a couple of really interesting cases, such as the case of Katie King, who was an entity that was supposedly created by a medium, still, without the infrared photography, they'd be sitting in the dark or in very bad red light. So that's why infrared was ever used. It wasn't that they thought they could catch a ghost because the ghost is reflecting infrared light. You know, ghosts don't give off heat. If anything, you know, people talk about cold, which is also not really the case, but it's not because we can't see in that range doesn't mean that's the range that they're in if they're visually appearing at all. So it's good. I think infrared's good if you're in a situation where you want to try to catch what else may be going on. It's certainly not going to hurt anything, but, you know, you can use those night shot cameras in the daytime also.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, they give off around – night shot gives off infrared light. You can actually use – most TV remote control devices are infrared, so if you need an infrared flashlight –
yeah, that can work. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Who was the medium that worked naked? I forgot her name.
Mina Crandon.
Yes.
That was a mediumship situation in the 20s and 30s that literally ripped apart the American Society for Psychical Research because of impropriety and accusations of fraud. Houdini was involved right before his death. There's all sorts of craziness going on.
Yeah, he didn't even want to go after her, did he?
Well, he did go after her. A lot of people think he framed her. The method that he claimed that she was doing to fake things is a little suspect, to be honest. That does not mean that she wasn't doing fraud. It just means that the method she was using was one that the great Houdini couldn't figure out. So the thought is that he may have framed her for that. There were also questions because, the woman actually did do some of her seances in the nude to prove that she had nothing on her, so to speak. And most of the researchers were, you know, older guys who apparently fought to be sitting next to her.
Must have been a very popular show.
I can't imagine. I don't know.
So there were some questions that might have offended certain people's sensibilities. I know it did. I worked at the ASPR in the early 80s with a woman named Marion Nestor, whose father was actually one of those researchers who was kind of on the outs with the guys who were pro-Marjorie. He was anti-Marjorie. And not necessarily because she wasn't a genuine medium, because of all the other stuff that was going on.
Right.
Well, Lloyd, I have a question. It's Diane. We've been taking clairvoyance classes, and we've had some interesting experiences. In my case, after meditating, I had visuals that turned out to be correct, and it seemed when I tried to actually visualize something, it didn't happen, but it just popped into my head. Do you think it's possible for an individual to develop their so-called third eye? Because any time I had the visual in my head, it actually turned out to be correct, and it just was kind of freaky. It's just like a picture that appeared in my head.
Yeah, I mean, that is what some people, some traditions, mystical traditions, call a third eye. Think of it as just literally a visualization process. You know, some people close their eyes and visualize almost anything they can think of. They can get a really clear picture. I'm pretty good at visualizing things myself. In other cultures, that's not always the case. People have to learn to do that. So it depends on whether you were a visualizer to begin with, a good visualizer to begin with, or if this is something, a process you need to learn. And you can definitely develop it. I mean, you can practice, do exercises just to think or picture things in your mind, and it certainly does help with remote viewing, with other types of psychic experience. It certainly would help, actually, even ghost experiences, for that matter.
Well, it was interesting because I would close my eyes and not try to force something, and then just something would pop visually, almost like seeing a picture in front of me.
Actually, yeah, and you want to, you know, you just kind of hit the nail on the head. Forcing your mind to do something that way doesn't work.
Right.
You really, you know, what remote viewing has taught us, the programs have taught us, is that while there are methods by which you can take step by step and kind of come to a picture, so to speak, through remote viewing, it's called controlled remote viewing. Most remote viewers who can just sit down, blank their minds, and just whatever pops in, whether it's visual, auditory, or otherwise, that's what you kind of pay attention to.
Well, that's exactly what happened to me, and mm-hmm. I checked with, you know, whoever I was visualizing about. And in the group, like in one case, it was Erica, and she was freaking out because she's like, you're reading my mind. And it was funny because something just popped into my head, a picture of something regarding Erica. And I asked her about it, and it turned out to be correct. And I didn't know anything about it. And it was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that hard to learn this stuff. It's just a matter of noticing that you already are a little bit psychic anyway. We're all a little bit psychic. And then just kind of clearing your mind and letting things pop in. That's the important thing, is really kind of having a quiet mind and letting things pop in, and then noticing, not trying to tear them apart, not trying to overanalyze things, because a lot of times psychic information is partial. A partial picture comes in, and most people tend to want to fill in the blanks, unfortunately.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, one of the courses I teach, which is the one I'm actually starting on the 9th, and I do most of my courses, I actually do distance learning as well. It is a course on being psychic, and one of the exercises we do is a remote viewing exercise where we kind of go through some of that.
Diana has signed up for your teleseminar courses. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. One of the things that has happened over the last couple of years, partly because of the economy, I think actually mainly because of the economy here in the States, is we've had fewer and fewer students, both locally and distance. And when I talk to people, because I would get a lot of people calling me or contacting the school asking, you know, I want to take the classes, and they'd say, but I can't afford it right now. You know, what can I do? So it occurred to me that it would be nice to offer separate lectures, separate, like, one-off type topical things on a much lower cost so that people could pay for whatever they want, buy an MP3 later on, and not have to worry about, you know, committing to a full course process. And so that's where the inception of the teleseminars came from. And I kind of looked very closely and long and hard at whether I wanted to do something on the web or not. And it really, the conclusion I reached was partly because of the experience of many of my distance students. You know, the way that our distance program actually works at HCH is I've recorded in MP3 all the classes, so audio recordings plus some video of other material, plus there's also written materials. And then I spend time on the phone with the students for each course. So I actually have contact with the students individually as well. But every one of the students has wanted to also call into the live classes, even if the time's not that great. I mean, you guys are on the East Coast. So I have people attending class from 9:30 to mid to 12:30 at night on the East Coast. And they call in. We have a speakerphone in the room. And people have really enjoyed kind of interacting and having that experience. So that really supported the whole telephone model. And then finally, the clincher was having my, well, beside the fact that my, you know, that even my broadband connection through my cable company is not 100% stable, which is a problem in itself, one of my students has gotten caught in traffic coming over to where we are on the other side of the bay from San Francisco, and so she dials into the class on her cell phone, puts it on speaker, and listens to the class on her way over.
That's
she misses,
great.
She comes late. And so she'll walk in, and she'll be listening to the phone as she walks in and hang up the phone. And that kind of made it real clear that telephones are much more sane, and I guess you could say they're ubiquitous. They're all over. Everybody's got a phone, so if you know, rather than getting to a computer and having to worry about your internet connection, because I've been on those web calls and web seminars, and sometimes takes an hour to even get them up and running. That doesn't work for me. So this is a really good way to do it. And so we're doing a lot of different topics. I've done two ghost topics, and very shortly I'll have the MP3s up on my website for those, for people to purchase and download. And then the next one is on psychics. It's from the genuine folks, the flakes, and the real people, you know, and the phonies.
Well, I'll be signing up for that. Mike listens in, too, so I really enjoyed the last two classes.
Yeah, right? Diane signed up for the last two, and I've really enjoyed listening in.
That's good. That's good. I'm glad to hear it. And, I want to try to make them a little bit more interactive. I am trying to get more people to attend them, I'm shooting for about 20, 25 people. I could really do a lot more than that, but I don't want to do that more than that. I want to also get people a chance to ask questions, as you've heard me do, and really try to get things a little bit more interactive where I can.
Yeah, I highly recommend for anyone listening to sign up for your teleseminars. They're very informative. The sad thing is, you know, there's probably some people in the field who may have a TV show and do something similar to what you're doing, and they'll get hundreds of people signing up, but they're really missing out on the wealth of knowledge you possess in the field, and it's always amazing talking with you and hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, we were wondering why you don't have your own television show.
Well, I've been close. Actually, there was a show we did a pilot. A group of us did a pilot back in the early 90s. We were really close to signing a contract.
Is that Haunted America?
That was Haunted America.
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, we were back then. There were a lot of syndicated shows, and somebody wanted to buy 65 episodes. That would have been great for us. But then they turned around and gave us the budget figures that they were willing to pay, and that they wanted the first show within 2 weeks. You know, 65 episodes means 5 shows a week, and they wanted the first show delivered in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So the budget was not high enough for us to travel to 65 possible different locations to do that many different shows. We would have limited to just L.A. and San Francisco area, which would have made it very difficult to find a lot of enough cases. And secondly, you know, 2 weeks, we had one show.
It was like a paranormal sweatshop.
Pretty much, yeah. So we turned it down, and unfortunately, the show's been sitting there. And I did a pilot for a major production company last year where I was the consulting producer on the show, so I was behind the scenes. I've worked on shows here and there. The reality, what I'm hearing right now when I get calls from people from production companies, is they want young. That's what they're looking for.
Unfortunately.
I may not be ancient, but they're looking for, at one point, actually, I was involved in negotiations with a local production company, actually helped them put the proposal together for a ghost hunting show. This is years ago, probably in the late 80s, late 90s. And it came down to our team not being good enough because our psychic wasn't young and pretty enough.
Oh God. Poor thing.
I mean, that's literally what it was. And, we had experienced psychics who were really to blow people away as opposed to what ended up. The show never it did make a pilot, didn't go anywhere because it just didn't come across very well with the psychic because she wasn't really a psychic, professional.
Well, you should call Henry Winkler and see if he can bring sightings back.
That would be great. You know, sightings, the first few years of sightings were really excellent. And then it started sliding downhill when Winkler and the main producers stepped away and let other people handle it. But I hope that they actually put out the early years on DVD at some point.
I mean, I devoured that show when it was on reruns. I'd watch it over and over again. It was great.
They were great. And even though they really weren't covering cases as extensively as some of us would have liked, they were the first few years, everybody involved in the production was very good about working with the families and really making sure people were taken care of. And then when that started slacking off and they were promising people things, in a couple cases, producer there promised a family follow-up by one of my colleagues, and he knew nothing about it, and it was in another state, and, the family said, when are you coming back? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, they promised they would bring you back, and he said, well, I will if they'll bring you back, and they basically, it was just a lot of hot air, and that's when we kind of backed off.
I'm hoping you get a show, Lloyd, because it's like a crime that you're not on television.
Well, sadly, the reality is, when I've been involved in some of the shows, even some of the segments that I've done for other shows, one of the things I've learned is how to get phenomena to happen while we're there. And that's something that is kind of magical in some respects. But it's not happening on television. It's not happening with the shows that we're seeing.
Yeah.
That's why they have to fake things or make things just slide things by in editing and such. And
well, it's all commercialized now. It's all just,
it's entertainment. And, reality TV is entertainment anyway, so you really can't get past that.
You have to take it with a grain of salt.
But what's
funny... Absolutely. Even the segments, I'm proud of some segments I've done in some shows, but even then, they're not telling the whole story.
Well,
they didn't have time to tell the whole story.
But it's funny, it seems that as years have gone on, the shows that were on earlier seemed more real than the shows that are on now. Like, it just seems more fluff and, you know.
Well, part of it is that people did have a longer attention span. documented. I mean, seriously, people had a longer attention span. They had like a 30-second attention span instead of a 5-second attention span. But that was a big, important thing. And you know, MTV actually probably more than anything influenced the way that movies and TV shows are shot and cut.
Sad but true. Yeah.
Well, when I was a kid, we used to watch a show called One Step Beyond. And
that's a show I watched early on, yeah.
Well, we actually got it on DVD recently. I haven't seen it since I was a kid because it's never on television, and you really can't see it. And I'm like, this is how when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, I used to watch that show. And that's how I learned a lot of those paranormal stories when I was a kid.
Well, that's a great way because those scripts were actually based on real reported experiences that people had.
Right, they were. That's what made it scary was that these things were real.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of like it was basically, you know, it went on a year before The Twilight Zone. I didn't even know that until a couple of years ago when I was reading a book about the show. But it was basically The Twilight Zone with real cases, real stories.
Yeah.
So I would recommend it highly. There's a 50-episode set you can buy on DVD really cheap these days.
Lloyd, I just want to know, who, if anybody, do you admire in the paranormal field?
I admire many people in the field of parapsychology. Charles Tart, who has a new book out called The End of Materialism, which is great. It really covers how science and spirituality come together. Dean Radin, who is an amazing guy, a good friend of mine, who wrote a book called Entangled Mind, which talks about quantum physics and psychic experience, and has a great lecture on the taboos of psi and the paranormal. If you Google his name, it's D-E-A-N, Dean, R-A-D-I-N. If you just Google that or put it into YouTube, actually, you'll get a really great lecture. He did actually at Google for the Google corporate people. Let's see, who else? Guy Lyon Playfair over in England, Tony Cornell over in England, both of whom have been investigating the paranormal probably longer than I've been alive.
Wow.
There, folks like that are really rare people, and they're still around with us, which is great, I think. And Gary Schwartz, the University of Arizona, there's a lot of folks whose names may be kind of alien to a lot of folks because they're not in the community, the paranormal community, because I guess you could say I'm in the greater community.
Right.
Well, it's a lot of people wouldn't know who you are, not because you're not important, but they would know Jason and Grant. It's just a matter of what you're exposed to.
Yeah, exactly.
The one person who he's a good buddy of mine, Jeff Belanger. I love his stuff. Jeff's a good goofball friend of mine. So.
Yes, Ghost Village.
Yeah, we've met him.
Great guy. Yeah. And there's a few other folks. I'm good friends with Chris Fleming, although, as I've told Chris, sometimes his psychic stuff kind of makes me look at him sort of funny. But he's a good guy, and he was involved with the pilot we shot actually last year. And then there's Al Rauber and Garrett Husfeth and Dan Sturgis, who I work with quite a bit. Pete Haviland, who's in Texas, and there's a lot of folks who are part of my network of folks. Dave Manganelli, there's a whole Pamela Heath is another person who's involved here locally, so who appears. Barry Taft is a friend of mine also.
Well, I have one more pressing question. Lloyd, with your education, knowledge, and experience, how well do you think you're going to do on the new Ghostbusters video game?
I bought it the other day. Okay, cool. So I started playing it. I got it for the Wii. Because I don't have a PSP, you know, or an Xbox or my, you know, it's different for each of the platforms. And I'm not really a gamer. Right away I have to learn some skills that I didn't have before. But I'm doing okay. I'm just moving around. So I haven't had a chance to play it a lot. It looks like a lot of fun. So far it's been kind of really interesting. And I've certainly been able to fire the proton pack quite a bit.
Keep missing that
damn Slimer, though.
That's great.
Well, are you going to be involved at all with the new Ghostbusters movie? I hear that they're planning to do a third one.
They are planning to do a third one. I'd love to say I was. I'd love to get involved in it. I can't imagine that they were going to reach out. You know, Dan Aykroyd has been a member of the American Society for Psychical Research for decades. His grandfather and great-grandfather was involved in the early days of psychical research. And he actually did research. He was actually at the ASPR on my days off when I was working there. I didn't know that until after he was there. And among the things he got from the education department were bios of all the people who worked there, including my own. And not that I can prove it, but many people have said because of what was told him, he talked to a couple of people who worked there. Many people who were around at that time have said that there's a little Lloyd Auerbach and Peter Venkman.
So you're married to Sigourney Weaver then?
Yeah, no. My wife does not float above the bed.
Not that you know of.
True.
All right, Lloyd. Well, we really got to wrap this up. We really appreciate your time that you've given us. Do you have anything to plug?
Well, again, just the teleseminars. I'm putting up the information on the latest one. It's currently up on my blog at MySpace. You just pop into myspace.com/LloydAuerbach, and it's Lloyd with one L. Or go to my website. There'll be a link there too. Mindreader.com is my website. Tons of stuff you can download free. The next teleseminar, which is on the 13th, will be of July, will be up. The information will be up tonight or tomorrow on that. And it is already up on my blog on MySpace as well. So there's that. And, of course, our Parapsychological Studies program, which you can get to from my website, or you can go to hypnotherapytraining.com and look for the parapsychology link on the left-hand side. That's the school that I teach at, HCH Institute. And we have our distance and local classes, and we're continuing to offer them. And there's a number of other similar things that I'll be doing. I'm going to be doing a little bit more, trying to do some more educational-type things. In fact, the Parapsychological Association convention in August in Seattle, which is coming up very quickly, I'll be doing a panel with Bill Everest, one of my former JFK students from many, many years ago. Bill's been investigating for quite a while himself, and we're going to do a panel on education and talk with, try to come up with ways of pooling the talents of the field, because there are little courses offered here and there, and we just want to really create a continuum, because there are no colleges or universities here in the States offering parapsychology classes. We're going to try to connect what is being offered by the research organizations and other places into one kind of seamless educational offering.
Good.
That's out there.
I like it.
Great. We could actually talk to you for hours and pick your brain. It's like we got all excited.
Many times, yes.
Well, we get all excited. We're going to talk to you. It's like, where do we start? We're sitting there going, where the heck do we start? We're talking to Lloyd Auerbach. It's like,
yeah. You started with chocolate. That was a good place.
Exactly. Nice opening line.
Well, why don't we finish with chocolate? You have Haunted by Chocolate. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. My website is www.hauntedbychocolate.com. I'm one of the other things, many things. I'm also a psychic entertainer, but one of the things that I do, because I got really interested, I just really love doing this. I started doing chocolate tastings, kind of like wine tastings. So I've done programs at a few colleges here and there, and corporations, corporate events. So we do kind of go through a chocolate tasting, which is a lot of chocolate trivia. There actually has been research on putting intentionality into chocolate to make the chocolate even more psychic than it is. So that's one of the topics that's in there. And I'm finally finishing up a book that I've been working on for a while called Haunted by Chocolate, How to Go from Chocolate to Chocolate Gourmet, which I'll be putting out in a few months. So to watch for that. And again, my website is hauntedbychocolate.com.
And that'll be called A Chocoholic's Handbook.
Well, you know, I'm telling people pass the chocoholic stage, because there's really, really good chocolate out there.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's funny. Yeah.
People need to move beyond Hershey's.
Oh, yeah.
You need to go to the dark side.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly.
Oh, I am so with you.
Best.
Absolutely.
I am the Sith Lord of chocolate. That's right.
Oh, yes. The darker, the better.
I like it. It's almost like baking chocolate. That's how good it is, except it's a little sweeter.
Yeah. We thank you so much again, Lloyd, for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Okay, I'm done.